Hi, I'm John Pasalis, and this is the Move Smartly Show. I've recently been researching, writing a lot on how our rapid population growth through migration has impacted our housing market. So today's episode is one I'm really excited about as Ermi and I talk to Mikkel Skuterud, an economic professor at the University of Waterloo who specializes in labor economics and immigration policy. Through his research and social media channels, Mikkel has been active in pointing out how the recent change in Canada's population growth strategy is putting stress on Canada's past success as an immigration nation. Together, we dig into how recent changes are impacting everything from our housing to our labor markets, and not always for the better. As always, if you'd like to get in touch with me about this episode or anything real estate related, you'll find my contact details in the show notes. And now, on to the show. All right, Mikkel, thank you so much for joining us on Move Smartly today to chat about some of the key questions that many are on many of our viewers' minds, in particular, how Canada's big population boom is impacting our economy, impacting housing, impacting so many things in people's lives. So I thought I'd kick things off maybe by chatting a little bit about Canada's migration system. You know, when people see our country growing by 1.2 million people per year, they kind of think that's all immigration, but there are of course a lot of buckets beneath that. So what are the different ways in which one can, gain the right to live in Canada?
So the distinction, I guess, at the highest level is the distinction between the right to live in Canada on a permanent basis, and that's what we call permanent residency, where you're de facto citizen. The only thing you wouldn't have as a permanent resident that you wouldn't have as a citizen is the right to vote and the right to hold a Canadian passport. But otherwise, a permanent resident, has access to public health care, all public schooling. So new permanent residents is one sort of inflow of people into the Canadian population that feeds into the population every year. But the other part is what we call temporary migration. And there are three big groups there. Those are international students, temporary foreign workers, and asylum claimants. And so those folks, certainly it's true that in the most recent years, you alluded to this quite dramatic increase in population growth in Canada. It is true that most of the growth is coming from the temporary inflows and not from the permanent. Where this gets a little bit complicated is they're not sort of mutually exclusive groups in the sense that what has happened in Canadian immigration over time is that we've moved towards what's called two-step immigration, in which new permanent residents are selected increasingly from the pool of temporary residents that are already living in Canada. And so you can't completely treat these populations as separate. And it's also true then, as a consequence of the fact that the way to permanent residency is increasingly through this pathway of temporary residency, it's true also that when you adjust policies on the permanent side, it's going to affect, have outcomes and effects in the temporary pool. They're very much related. They're not independent.
That's helpful. Now, when we look at the historic levels, recently we've seen this big jump in 2015 and since COVID at our Canada's population growth rate. I mean, we're growing by about 1% per year pre-2015. We've hit 3%. What has happened, And I think that's kind of the big, what has happened in this time that has brought us to this point? What has changed since, pre-2015 and the 20 years before that?
There's just no question at all that this is very much a part of the Liberal government's economic growth strategy. If you read all of the kind of reports of the Economic Growth Council that was set up in 2016, if you read a lot of the kind of talking points of the Liberal government between 2015 and 2022, it was all about this notion that the way to increase economic growth, to kind of deal with all these economic problems in Canada, was to lean on immigration more. So it was very much a part, it's really a key pillar of the Liberal government's policy. And so it's not a coincidence. When you look at the data, what you see is that these immigration rates start to take off exactly in 2015. As you said, they were about 0.8% of the population. The new permanent residents as a percentage of the population was about 0.8. And now it's gone up to about 1.2% of the population. If you add in the temporary migration inflows, it's about 3%. So there is a question about whether the really dramatic increases in the temporary migration inflows are part of the plan, and I think it's pretty clear it isn't. What I do think, though, that is that what is happening on the permanent immigration side and the policy changes there are having an impact on what's happening on the temporary side. I don't think they're independent. So I don't think sort of the Liberal government just can clean their hands of what's happening. I think they're very much part and parcel of the same policy initiatives, but I don't think it was part of the plan to have 3% year-over-year population growth. I definitely, John, don't think that's the plan.
Interesting. So that was, so then how does that happen? I mean, you know
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I wish we talked a little bit more about that. We asked a little bit about why it's happening. Because in order to, I mean, I think it's pretty clear most people understand. Let me just try to convince you, the listeners first that it matters, right? So, and that there's potentially a risk here that having that much growth in the temporary population is potentially risky. And here's the kind of the big issue here. One is that, you know, as I said, if temporary immigrants come to Canada in the hope of making this transition to permanent residency, and I think it's true. I've seen, you know, like in the foreign student population, something like 80 to 90% of international students that come to Canada are hoping to make that PR transition. Okay, if that's true, and the population of the temporary residents is growing much faster because it's not capped. There are no kind of targets for that population, how much growth there is in that population. And suppose that population is growing much faster than the new permanent resident inflow, which is capped, very strictly capped. So then you get this unbalancing. And what's inevitably going to happen is that increasingly folks are going to find themselves unable to make that transition. And in particular, folks who were hoping to make, who came to Canada under the belief that they would be able to make that transition. And when that becomes a problem, then you have to ask, well, what do these folks do? Do they return home, or do they overstay their visas and try to survive in Canada without any legal status? And I think there's no question that some of these folks, it isn't easy just to return home. There are financial constraints. It's just not that simple. And so there's no question that the risk is that you're going to get a growing undocumented population. Now, why did it happen, you asked? Well, I think a big part of why it happened is that this select, it, you think of it kind of like there are two gatekeepers. The first set of gatekeepers are those who are controlling the inflow into temporary status. That's predominantly post-secondary institutions who bring in foreign students and employers, businesses that bring in temporary foreign workers. Then there's another gatekeeper that controls the flow from temporary to permanent status. That's the federal government entirely. IRCC has sole jurisdiction to control that gate. Now, what has happened at that gate is that very explicitly the federal government has said we are going to change our who we prioritize and who's coming through that gate. Not only are we increasing the levels that more people are coming through the gate, but also we're going to emphasize lower skilled workers. We've been too focused on high skilled workers. We're going to allow all kinds of workers to come through, even very low skilled workers. What that says to the world and migrants around the world who have a demand or have an appetite or willingness to pay for Canadian PR status is if you get here and if you're a lower skilled worker, you're going to have a better chance of getting through that second gate. And so now your willingness to pay the first gatekeeper, either the student, either the post-secondary school or the business through, you know, accepting really low-wage jobs, your willingness just to get into that temporary status is much higher because now your odds of making it to PR has gone up. And I think that's a big part of what's happening here. I think there's little doubt in my mind that if they hadn't opened up the PR transition pathways to lower skilled workers, that we wouldn't be seeing that. Because who's going to come and pay really high tuition fees at some strip mall college if you know there's no chance that will ever lead you to a high to PR status? You're just not going to make that move. And I think that's a big part of what's happening.
That's super interesting. Now, you know, one thing you write about are the, you know, the bigger effects on the economy that this massive population boom is having on citizens, in particular, potentially like lower waged, you know, impacts on rent. So what I guess are the concerns that you have with a population that's growing this rapidly in Canada? And what are some of the negative side effects of that?
So I will say, you know, I've been critical of the Liberal government's, you know, narratives around this policy for a long time. I mean, for economists, and it's not just me, for academic economists who've been studying, you know, immigration for years, the economics of immigration in Canada for years, that hyperbolic discussion about, you know, that heightened immigration would be an antidote to all our economic problems, including our labor productivity problems, that narrative just didn't ring true to economists who study immigration in Canada. It was very much exaggerated. And so we've been critical about that. But that in large part is not about, you know, going from an immigration rate of 0.8% to 1.2%. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what they were planning on the permanent side. You know, if done well, and in particular, if, you know, you really prioritize high-skilled immigrants, you do a really good job in selecting, maybe even you do a better job in attracting kind of talent, it's entirely possible you could go from 0.8 to 1.2 and not have any of these kind of adverse effects that concern us. But that's not what has happened. So my criticism and concern is actually much more about not just the numbers, but much more about the composition of the inflow and what kinds of workers are being prioritized in the inflow. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that Canada has historically been successful because it's prioritize skilled immigration. We refer to Canada's skilled immigration policy. We have been the envy of the world for decades for our skilled immigration policy and how successful it is. I mean, one of the key facts of why skilled immigration works well is that what it tends to do is, if anything, put downward pressure on people's wages at the top end of the labor market, because that's who's competing with newcomers, are the skilled workers at the top end. Professors like me are competing with foreign professors educated all over the world. I don't think that's such a bad thing, right? If anything, that makes us work harder at the top and push, it reduces, if you put downward pressure at the top, you reduce inequality. If instead you prioritize immigration at the lower end of the labor market, lower skilled workers, that puts downward pressure, if anything, on wages at the bottom end, or it doesn't allow wages to grow in the way they otherwise would at the bottom end. That tends to increase inequality, right? So the way I always describe it is that I think immigrant, or like new immigrants, but even Canadians in Canada that look at immigration, they always kind of had a tendency to look at immigration as something that potentially lifts all boats, that we're sort of all better off because we look at doctors and professors and scientists, the immigrants we see around us are like, my God, these people are people that make our country and my life better. They're not people who are competing with me. But increasingly, that's what's happening in Canada with the nature of the immigration, is it's lower skilled immigrants. They're concentrated in particular neighborhoods. And if you're a recent immigrant who lives in these neighborhoods, you're going to feel those growing pains a lot more, because, you know, you're going to compete for rental housing at the lower end, you got to compete for jobs at the lower end, and you're going to feel those pains a lot more. And I don't think it's a surprise, John, when you look at the most recent polling in Canada that's been done by Environics and the Century Initiative, surprisingly enough, their polling shows that the biggest increases in dissatisfaction with current immigration levels are among first-generation immigrants. And I think that's because they tend to be the people living in these communities like Brampton and Scarborough, and that are struggling for rental housing, that are really feeling the growing pains. And so for people like me that are sort of buffered from all of that, I own my home, and it's easy for us to kind of think, well, what's the big deal with all this increased population growth? But I think other segments of the population feel it differently.
So I found that really interesting. Some great interesting linkages you're making that I'm not sure I was always aware of. Now I'm going to approach this a little bit. I was a very lowly policy analyst in Finance Canada. And I remember from the late 2000s, I worked in international trade and finance division. The impetus, even as late in the late 2000s, was to really grow Canada's tradable services sector. So we were going to outsource our expertise in banking, we're going to export our consultancies, our consultants, and education through marketing that education to foreign students. There was a Harper Era advisory group, I believe, who released one of the landmark documents that informed a lot of this thinking in 2012, International Education, a Key Driver of Canada's Future Prosperity, which was already linking this idea of attracting foreign students to also solving our working population aging problem and other ills in society. And then in 2014, under the Harper Government Economic Action Plan, millions of dollars were dedicated to marketing towards foreign students in five key markets: India, China, Turkey, Brazil, and Vietnam. So these countries even then happened to be some of the biggest sources of migration to Canada. So hasn't there always been, not just 2015 onwards, but even before, this tacit idea that, you know, if you come as a student, you are going to be likely to stay, that foreign education isn't really, as many are complaining now, a backdoor to permanent residency, but an attractive reason to choose Canada for it? And hasn't this part of been a part of a longer pitch?
It absolutely is. So that's a great question. You're absolutely right. It is part of a longer term strategy. I think you can date it back actually initially to the innovation strategy. There is a document, if you Google search it, the innovation strategy. I think the document's from 2002. It was the Chrétien government. And that was where, at least, I've tried to trace this back to see the genesis of this shift towards international students. You can see very clearly in that document that that's about trying to attract the world's top talent to draw, to kind of raise the average human capital of the population and bring all these other benefits that come with a really smart, high-teched up, lots of STEM workers, all this kind of stuff to drive innovation. That goes way back to at least two decades, if not more, right? So you're absolutely right. There's no question this kind of strategy has a lot of potential. Absolutely no question. If done well, has potential. One of the main benefits we know, and I have research on this showing that, if you look at the earnings of immigrants who are educated in Canada compared to new immigrants that have only foreign education, Canadian education has higher returns. Those immigrants integrate more easily. They don't face these credential recognition assessment problems because they have Canadian credentials. So there's a lot to be said for an international student strategy. But it's the usual problem. If something is good, there is a limit to that potential, right? Some is good, but too much can be a problem. And I mean, we've clearly pushed on this potential too hard. And so by pushing on the potential, what do I mean? Well, it's no longer. So look, if you look, if your viewers want to do this, go and look at the data. Look at the data and see where in recent years the growth, the phenomenal growth in international student entries, where it is, where are those students headed? They are not headed to the top universities in Canada. Now, people say, well, that's snobbish to say. I actually heard the immigration minister say the other day that, giving priority to university-educated immigrants and PhDs and master's students, that's snobbery. That we don't want to do that. We want to open up immigration to all skill levels. I find that, asinine, to be quite frank. I find that quite ridiculous. I mean, there's lots of good reasons to open up immigration to broader groups. There's very good humanitarian reasons, but this is an economic class immigration program. It's about leveraging immigration to drive the economic benefits of immigration. So it's very clear to any economist the way you do that is through raising the average human capital of the population. It's not bringing in workers that are working at Tim Hortons and McDonald's. It's bringing in PhDs in computer science that drive, that produce patents, that produce startups, that produce, that drive new job growth. I mean, it's very clear that that's so. Where all of the growth is happening is not at the University of Waterloo or Toronto or UBC. Look at the intakes of international. They're flat. And in Waterloo, they're declining over the last 3 years. The share of the new incoming undergrads in the math faculty, which is one of the most competitive programs in Canada, that's where the computer science is at University of Waterloo. Their share of international students was about, I think, 46%. It's below 40% now. It's going down. Where's all the growth in Kitchener-Waterloo? Conestoga College. These are two-year diplomas that for the most part don't lead to high earnings jobs after graduation for these folks. And large numbers will struggle even to become permanent residents. So that's not how you leverage this program to drive economic growth. It's gone off the rails. We've lost sight of what is the objective of the international student program. And oh, maybe I'll say, I mean, why has it gone off the rails? Well, I mean, it comes back to what I said before. The gatekeepers in the first step, that is the gatekeepers into this non-permanent resident status, are in large part the post-secondary institutions. And because they control that gate, and because migrants realize the only way to PR status, which they're willing to pay a lot of money for, is through that gate, now you can monetize that educational credential. You can tell students, the only way you're going to get PR status is to come to our school. We're not necessarily going to teach you anything very valuable, but you got to get that credential. And we're going to charge you four, five, six times. In Waterloo, they're charging six times as much to the international students. An international student in the computer science program pays $77,000 per year at the University of Waterloo now, right? So they're charging huge amounts of money for these students to make these transitions. And there's just like a massive amount of money to be made. And that's what's driving that growth for sure.
That's actually very eye-opening, and our viewers won't be surprised to hear that we've actually spoken about that growth in that college, not only colleges that we would recognize, but in some of these other colleges. Mikhail's Twitter is a great follow, or ex-Twitter. It's a great follow for some of those stats as well. I just want to dig a little bit now into another linkage. So you've written and been critical about student visas with work allowances, almost turning into this federal government desire to secure cheap labor for businesses here. But isn't the offering of student visas, along with that pathway to PR, permanent residency, always been part of this shifting calculus that competing governments, I'm talking about countries like Canada, Australia, the UK, are tending to go after the same types of students. It's part of this shifting equation. Need another a certain number of students? Well, you shift these two variables here. The writer Nicholas Hune Brown, I thought, said this really eloquently in his 2022 Walrus article. I'm quoting here, adjusting those two variables, the ability to work and the pathway to permanent residency, PR, is how governments try to control the flow of students, create a more favorable path to PR by, for example, assigning more points to those getting a Canadian degree, as Canada did in 2016, and you open the faucet wider. Restrict the ability to work post-graduation, as the UK did in 2010, and the market dries up. I also note that about 2 weeks ago, the UK obviously has moved off of that policy because there was complaints in their parliament about Deliveroo student visas. Again, this idea that you're not really offering a student visa, you're offering someone to come in and work a job, maybe driving for Uber Eats more than anything. So again, is this really a conceptual policy problem, that linking that student visa, work visa, and permanent residency pathway? Or is it more that things just got really corrupt and out of control? Once a market gets really developed, you see rent-seeking behavior, unscrupulous actors enter. And then the last 10 years, particularly in Ontario, you just touched upon this explosion of strip mall degrees. These aren't even public colleges. These are private operators who are able to license the curriculum of public colleges in Ontario. Plus their entourage of shady operators. I understand a brother duo out in Montreal are one of the biggest international student recruiters in Canada. And they've made a pretty penny going out to farming communities in India, attracting students to these programs. So is it really that policy thinking that I think we've both spoken about has been pretty longstanding, or was it the corruption of it?
You know, if I was a student recruiter, whether one of these agencies that's recruiting and earning commissions, or the post-secondary institutions themselves, or if I'm a business in Canada, and I'm trying to recruit, you know, foreign students to come and work and study in Canada, then I want some carrots. You know, having some carrots to offer is really helpful. And two of those carrots that are going to be more helpful than anything are, one, if you come here and earn a diploma or or certificate at my college, you will have a certain path to PR status. If I can offer that, that's hugely influential in attracting students. Two, you don't need a lot of savings, because while you're studying, you can work full time. And so you don't really, in our programs, need to always go to class. You know, if you got a job and working 40, 50, 60 hours a week, that's okay. You'll, you know, we're not, our expectations are not that high. We will still pass you, and you'll get your credential, and you can earn money and pay for your tuition. And that's a real win-win, because now businesses benefit. They get the labor they need. The colleges get the tuition they need. Landlords get the rent that they want from all these students. I mean, everybody's a winner in this proposition, right? Why would you ever restrict inflows through that? That's the thinking that has led to opening up the PR pathways to lower skilled migrants and relaxing all restrictions on work activity during study, off-campus work activity. It seems like a no-brainer. Why would you not do this? Well, the reason you wouldn't do it is because, of course, what it does is it leads, there's no control on the inflow, and now you have this massive growth in this population of foreign students, because they've all been attracted by this lure of work rights and PR status, right? Now, here's the key that nobody likes to talk about, because in the modern world, it's not polite to note that we all aren't equal in our contributions to the economy, that there are high-skilled workers and lower-skilled workers. Sometimes we call this high quality and low quality, which really isn't so nice when you're talking about people. But what we're talking about, it's not the people themselves. There are lots of wonderful immigrants that work in low-skilled jobs. That's not what this is about. It's about the economic contribution of people. And the reality is, we don't all contribute equally to the economy. That's just a simple, hard reality, right? And so when you change work rights and rights to PR status for lower skilled workers, you affect the composition of the inflow. The skill composition or quality composition of the inflow changes in a very fundamental way. You attract the lower end, who otherwise, under the very strict PR rules, would not have been successful. Those are the people whose behavior changes when you relax those PR admission rules, right? So now you get growth at the bottom end, the lower skilled end of the foreign student population. This is not, you know, students who are studying. I teach lots of international students, and I talk to lots of international students. For the most part, they're not working. They're not even working part-time, right? They're focused on their studies. Many of them have no intention of settling in Canada, but even those that want to settle in Canada are very much focused on their studies. They're not working full-time, and they're not worried about making the PR transition. They're in a co-op program. They're going to get a skilled job. If you're doing economics or computer science at Waterloo, you're going to get a skilled job. You're going to make that PR transition. So it's not, those carrots are not affecting those students. It's affecting the students at the lower quality schools. That's who's being attracted. And so now, again, you have to ask yourself, well, what are we trying to achieve here, right? If the idea is to leverage the international student program to attract and retain talent to drive economic growth, then this is not the way to do it. It's completely backwards.
That's, I think, super, that leads helpful. Us to productivity, workforce productivity.
And that's exactly, yeah, it does lead us perfectly, because we're going to ask you about that. I mean, how this connects with something that you talk about a lot, which is Canada's productivity, our labor productivity, and how does this plan to ramp up sort of the lower end of the skill labor force impact Canada's productivity? And maybe you can kind of unpack some of those ideas that you...
Yeah. So I think there's two main mechanisms or channels through which immigration can affect the macroeconomy. You know, the target I would focus on is, you know, labor productivity is maybe a little bit more difficult to measure, but it's not really that different. The real measure you want to focus on is GDP per capita. GDP is gross domestic product. Very crudely, it's kind of the value of everything that's produced in an economy within a year. It's a flow. Within a year, how much, what's the value of all the stuff that's produced? So we can measure that. We have data on that. If we take that total GDP and we divide it by the population, we have GDP per capita. That's sort of like, you know, the total economic pie, and we're going to divide it into equal size slices for everybody in the country, and it's the size of the average slice. And we want, when we increase immigration, for the size of that average slice to get bigger. But it's not obvious it does, right? Because one, when you add more people to the population, the pie, the whole pie gets bigger, for sure. As long as some of those people are producing something, which they definitely do, the pie is going to get bigger. But you're also now cutting it into more slices because there's more people in the population. And so it's not obvious that the average slice gets bigger. And so really, labor productivity is about trying, increasing labor productivity is about trying to make that average slice bigger. So there are two mechanisms, I said, to kind of do that. One is, and this is the part that kind of works against increasing immigration rates, is we know if you look across countries or even within countries over time, one of the most important determinants of the size of the average slice is how much capital every worker has to work with on average. What is capital? We use capital as a word, and it kind of means different things in financial markets and other kinds of markets. For economists, it's physical capital. It's basically all the stuff that allows you to be productive. It's stuff from like the machinery and equipment in a workplace, to the offices, to the factories. It's all the public infrastructure, schools and hospitals and public transportation systems. It's like intellectual property, all the patents and innovations that allow workers to do things a bit differently, to exploit new technologies that allow every worker to produce more on average. If you go to poor countries, you know, some of your listeners have probably traveled around developing countries, what you see is, of course, productivity is very much, production is much more labor intensive. Every worker has less tools and equipment and capital to work with. And that means they're going to produce less on average. And that's what makes the poor, those countries poor. In Canada, we have lots of capital per worker, but it's a problem. So when you increase immigration, what you want at 3% per year, you want to make sure that the capital stock is growing at least 3% per year as well. And what's happening in Canada, when you look at the data, is that clearly is not happening. Canada has a long-standing capital investment problem, long before we ramped up immigration. So, I mean, we can't blame it on immigration. But the point is an environment in which capital investment is a problem, the right environment to leverage increased immigration from already high rates to boost economic growth? And the answer is no, clearly not. What it will tend to do is dilute the capital stock even further. So there's less capital per worker. And if you look at the most recent data, capital per worker in Canada is falling. It's not that it's flat, it's falling. And so is GDP per capita, right? The average size of the slice is falling in Canada. So that's a worry. When you're in a country where GDP per capita is falling, it means on average we're getting poorer. You know, if you care about programs, progressive programs like Canada Child Benefits programs, that where we distribute the size of the slice from people with bigger slices to people with lower slices through government programs, you know, when the average slice is getting smaller, people are going to be a lot more hesitant to support governments that are interested in sharing pies from rich to poor, right? When the rich are getting poorer themselves, they're going to. So I think that worries me a lot. I think there's reasons to worry about a falling GDP per capita. Now, I'll just say one other thing. So we have this capital dilution problem. And I should emphasize too that, of course, the housing stock is very much a part of the country's capital stock. And the way I, as an economist, think about how housing makes us more productive is, of course, you know, it's just like any capital allows us to be more productive. It allows us to sleep at night. allows us to get a good rest at night in a quiet place, that we wake up in the morning, we're refreshed, and we can go to work and be productive. If we're sleeping out on the street or crammed into a place that's noisy, we're not going to sleep so well. So that just like any machinery or equipment, housing's really important for the productivity, labor productivity of an economy, hugely important. Anyways, the other part that's really important in raising GDP per capita and labor productivity is human capital, not physical capital, but human capital. And that's where Canada has had an advantage historically, is that what we have in Canada, and again, nobody likes to talk about this, but the reality is that we have a country that's surrounded for the most part by oceans. We're pretty much an island, except for a southern border that's not porous. You know, U.S. Americans are not, you know, pouring into Canada. There aren't real, you know, issues with lower skilled migration from the southern border coming into Canada. European countries, the U.S., have a very different kind of border, very porous border with lower skilled migrants. So Canada's never had to deal with that. What that means is they've been able to set up an immigration system in which they largely can pick and choose. The reality is there are far more people seeking permanent residency status in Canada than the slots that we allow, the caps that we allow. So there's a long queue. And what Canada has done since 1967 is have a point system where we pick and choose the highest skilled. And that has led to, I think, is largely attributable to the reason for the strong public support is because we have that kind of system. And so it's all about trying to select immigrants who are going to raise that human capital, are not going to increase in economic inequality in society. That's why this works. And unfortunately, you know, with this government, why I've been critical is I think on both of those channels, they've kind of screwed things up, to be blunt. Right. On the one hand, they've increased immigration rates to 3%, while in capital investment is sluggish at less than 1%. Capital is growing at less than 1%. That's a problem. Two, if there is any hope for us, it's through raising the average human capital. But they've moved away from that to something about like. They've been kind of caught up in this narrative around labor shortages, which I just find to be complete economic nonsense, that this is a problem that needs to be dealt with.
Yeah.
Thank you. That is actually leads me so well into a couple of questions I want to ask you linked. Now, bear with me. I think these are a little bit more like sort of counter conceptual questions. So, first of all, do we maybe risk trying to control immigration, our economy too much through Canada's approach to immigration? And what I mean by that is, while massive immigration, the idea of it, you mentioned really porous borders in the US and Europe, make us, you know, understandably very nervous. If we look at some of those economies, are always having a select small group of very well-educated people always the full story when it comes to economic productivity? If we look at the US, where illegal migration is a part of their calculus, I think I've just tried to look at some stats, so forgive me if they're not absolutely correct. Maybe illegal immigration is 3% of the population, but in the workforce, it's represented well above that, because those tend to be the people that try to come to the United States. So there, I saw some estimates of 5%, maybe a bit higher. And considering that workforce disproportionately works in agriculture and construction, and there's long been this argument that U.S., for example, housing has a more elastic ability to respond to demand because they're not as constrained when it comes to labor, construction labor issues, because there are these people, and in California, I've seen them, there's these informal pickup joints. Where pickup points, not joints, sorry, that's something else. But these informal pickup points where you see day laborers lining up and vans will come by and, you know, probably say, I have a job out here, I have a job out there. Now, let's put aside the human part of that story, which there is so much suffering in, and let's just put that aside. Is there something to the fact that maybe not being so picky about which kind of workers we let in leads to some unintended positive benefits?
If you like economic inequality, then absolutely. You know, if I'm somebody who benefits from a servant class in my economy, then absolutely. Then we should be prioritizing low-skilled migration. If I like somebody to do all the service work around my house and a live-in nanny to take care of my kids, and I want to be able to attract those people at very low wages, then absolutely, that's the right policy. So it really always comes back to what is the objective. And we've written a paper recently that has had some attention, which I encourage your readers to look at. You can find it on the website of the Canadian Labor Economics Forum. It's called, the title of the paper is The Economics of Canadian Immigration Levels. But we make the case that the most reasonable objective, policy objective for economic, not humanitarian immigration, but for economic class immigration in Canada is to raise GDP per capita. That where we include the new immigrants in the population of people in which we're calculating GDP per capita. Listen, the U.S. has a very different experience with immigration. What U.S. immigration is very bipolar. They have sort of porous borders with very low skill inflows at the bottom end, mostly in the southern states, in California and in Florida, you see a lot of that immigration as well. So they have, very low, but at the other end of the distribution, they are exceptional at attracting talent at the top end. And that effect, I would say, actually dominates any effect on the economy of the other. But immigration, therefore, certainly leads to increased inequality in the U.S. And there are papers showing that that is true. In Canada, immigration, if anything, historically has tended to lower economic inequality. In the U.S., it's served to increase inequality. Now, the total immigration rates in the U.S. are about 0.5% of the population. As I said, we're moving up to permanent immigration 1.2%, and if you include temporary, 3%, way higher immigration rates. The other thing, though, is the skilled part of the distribution, the upper end of the distribution in the U.S. is exceptional. Let me tell you about one paper. So what we did is we took immigrants that are university educated. So we just focused on university educated immigrants in the US and in Canada. And we looked at them in an apples to apples kind of way, or oranges to oranges, we looked at immigrants from the same origin countries. So from India or China or the Philippines. And we said, let's look at these immigrants from the same origin country, let's say Indian immigrants, and compare them to the native born within each country, who are similar at a similar point in their life cycle and also have a university degree. So Indian immigrants, we compare to US-born immigrants, Indian immigrants in Canada to Canadian-born immigrants, and look at their earnings. How well are they doing in the labor market? What you see is in the US, the Indian university-educated immigrants are far outperforming their US-born counterparts that are university-educated. Their earnings are like 10 to 20% higher on average. If you do the exact same analysis in Canada, the Indian university educated immigrants are far underperforming the Canadian born benchmark, far underperforming. Why is that? Well, it's nothing to do with how the governments are selecting immigrants, it's self-selection. So the US, we know, is very unequal. And Canada's income distribution is much more equal, right? So if I'm an immigrant and I know that I'm exceptionally talented, I'm ambitious, I want to be rich, I'm going to work hard, and I am smart, where am I going to want to go? I want to go to the U.S. because if I'm at the top end of the distribution when it's more unequal, I'm going to be way richer. I'm going to be way better off in the U.S. than in Canada because those returns to my skill are way higher. If, on the other hand, I'm an immigrant that I'm not so sure about my abilities, I'm not so sure that I fall into the top end of the distribution, I feel like I'm much more average or maybe even a little bit below average, and I'm more worried about falling through the cracks and struggling to integrate into this new economy, then I'm much happier in Canada because there's a social safety net there. My kids will get a good education, at least they'll do well even if I struggle. There's a public healthcare system that I don't have to worry about having a job. I'm going to be taken care of, my health will be taken care of regardless. I'm going to be attracted. So we tend to attract very different types of immigrants. And what that means is the U.S. at the top end, those Indian immigrants they go to the top schools in the U.S., and through the H-1B program, the employers cream skim that talent from Princeton and Harvard and MIT and Stanford. And those students, those graduates do incredibly well. In Canada, we struggle. And that's in particular true when immigration is actually not, the number of international students at these top schools, where we really should be leveraging these schools like Waterloo and the university to attract the top talent. We're not seeing any growth there. All the growth is at the college level, community college level, and even below that, in kind of private strip malls. That's not how you do this. So, yeah.
On that front, I actually just thought of something just right now. What did you think of the federal government initiative in Canada appealing to those people in the States on those those visas, that had you not been offered something in the United States and you're a holder of those, because we know the U.S. are very strong at vetting those. I have my own family history, like our entire history for several generations on is on who got it and who didn't.
Okay.
So there is a strong vetting system there, as you were saying. The Americans are actually very restrictive when it comes to their point system, if you will. So the federal government said, hey, if you failed to get something in the U.S., apply to Canada. And apparently they had 10,000 spots, and they went like hotcakes in a day.
Yep. So I don't know how many actually came to Canada. That's going to be an interesting study. But when that policy came out, I mean, go back to my Twitter feed. My post was something to the effect of, wow, what a breath of fresh air. Finally, an economic class immigration problem that has a well-defined objective that looks to achieve that objective. That is probably the smartest policy I've seen come out of IRCC in the past 5 years.
Interesting. So that was announced, I think, by Sean Fraser. I haven't heard much of what happened to it under the new immigration minister in Ottawa, Mark Miller. So that's interesting. Now, going back to my counter sort of conceptual, maybe push back. Okay, so let's not talk about, let's say, the bottom tier of the U.S. economy. What about the idea that Canada, through its point system, we do prioritize, let's call them middle-class professionals. So you are not, as some of my relatives are in the United States, on what they call an extraordinary alien visa. That is, you know, when you're that top talent, I think that's an O class. So like you were saying, that example of like, I'm talented, I'm going to go to the States, I can knock it out of the park, right?
Yep.
But between that and someone maybe that's struggling as a laborer, maybe doing gig economy jobs, there's a huge middle class of middle class professionals, you know, white collar workers of all kinds, you know, scientists, where we're talking lab scientists, researchers, maybe people in big corporations, analysts, things like that. That group, through our point system, Canada and Australia has tended to prioritize. Now, one of the criticisms there is, A, we haven't had some of the, I don't want to say low skill, but let's say higher skilled trades and those types of immigration that we could use when it comes to expanding our housing supply. But I'm going to take it a step further. Does that not also hurt a little bit what I'm going to say our productivity issue through a different way? I understand that in that middle tranche, the U.S. Relies on 70% what they call family reunification. So you are well established in the United States. You have the right to sponsor relatives then. In fact, I believe that's how Donald Trump got his wife's family into the United States, right? So it's that, and that is a flip of what Canada allows in terms of percentages, because we tend to go for that point system skill-based immigration. Now, of that tranche of people entering the United States, so they have some setup, they have some resources. Is there enough of a drive to succeed and kind of establish yourself that results in a higher hustle culture there? You know, not desperate, but more of a hustle culture, as opposed to Australia and Canada, where if you're a middle-class professional, not only can you come in, you can probably buy a house right away and a lot faster. So in Canada, not only does that put immediate pressure on our housing system, then how much do you take your assets and plow it back into housing rather than setting up a business or really going out and trying to make it? You know, is there a way where we're kind of attracting the comfortable class, if that makes any sense? And that's hurting our productivity.
So first, I like hustle culture. This is excellent. And that is a feature of the U.S. There's absolutely no question. And it's part of that sort of inequality, right? That you got to work so much harder just to make sure you're sort of getting up that ladder. The rungs on the ladder might be a little further apart, let's say, or you just got to work a lot harder. And so if you look at like hours of work, weekly hours of work, they're way higher in the U.S. The Americans work a lot more hours than
Which is a measure of productivity. Is that correct? The official GDP per capita productivity GDP measure.
The GDP per capita measure, the labor productivity measure is usually the GDP, not divided by the number of people, but the number of hours worked, total hours worked. So just increasing hours worked, if anything, is going to make labor productivity smaller because we have diminishing returns. We're getting tired. You know, I'm more productive in the first hour I work than the 50th hour in the week that I work. So making people work lots more overtime is probably not going to raise our labor productivity. But nonetheless, it will raise GDP per capita. The question about the middle, the kind of middle skill individuals, I think there is some misunderstanding. So what has happened? When I say the rules of the PR selection system have changed, essentially prior to these rules being changed, there was a clear cutoff that if you didn't have what the system called a skilled job in Canada as one of these like graduates of a school, or you were trying to make this PR transition, if you didn't have a skilled job, you just didn't qualify, like need not apply. Well, what's a skilled job? Well, people think that means, you know, like this is people with degrees, university degrees. Absolutely not. Includes a lot more people than that. So we have what's called the National Occupational Classification System in Canada. You know, they're at the most detailed level, there's like 600 occupations. Everybody fits into one of these occupations. They're just, you know, codes. And every one of these occupations, the government has assigned what the educational requirements are. So there's like a five-tier system. At the highest level are jobs that require a university degree. At the lowest level are jobs that require less, don't even require a high school diploma. The cutoff for a skilled job to qualify for skilled immigrant or economic class immigration in Canada has historically been that if you're in an occupation that requires high school or less, need not apply. But anything above high school, so that definitely includes skilled trades. Absolutely. If you're a carpenter, if you're any kind of a technical worker in the healthcare industry, you know, you do ultrasounds or any kind of that, absolutely. Nurses, all that, absolutely. That's skilled. There's a special program in Canada specific, and it's been there for a long time, specifically targeting skilled trades workers, right? So that's the first thing. There certainly were PR pathways. What they have opened up are the pathways for the folks with high school that have jobs that require high school or less, right? So these are really the lower skilled groups. That's where the growth has been. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now let's also be clear about another thing. So there is research in economics. In fact, Pierre Fortin, who's has the Order of Canada, former president of the Canadian Economics Association, really reputable economist in Canada, an old guard, He's still working. He emails me once in a while. We talk. He's doing work on this that, looking at the relationship between immigration and labor shortages. Is there a potential for immigration to address labor shortages? For example, in skilled trades, we have a shortage of, there's no evidence there's a shortage of skilled trades workers in Canada. If you look at wages of skilled trades workers, it just does not hold up in the data. But let's suppose that there's just some unsatisfied demand there. Is it true that immigration can meet that need? The answer is, as Pierre is finding out in this research, will be coming out within the next year, is that no, it doesn't seem to do much. And the reason is quite simple. If you have a particular labor shortage in a particular sector, then what you do is you use all the immigration to feed that sector. But immigrants are consumers in many markets. They don't just buy houses, they consume in lots of other markets. If you now are only getting immigrants exclusively that are producing in the housing market, and are not producing in any other markets, now you're going to create shortages in all kinds of other markets because now we don't have any immigrants producing all kinds of other stuff. So it's like a game of whack-a-mole, right? You're just trying to fill the immigrants in this hole and it's just creating holes in other places. It doesn't deal with general like tight labor markets. The bigger problem I have with this idea of labor needs and using immigration to plug these holes is I just find the whole idea that a tight labor market is a problem perverse. You know, we all kind of understand that if you have a surplus of labor in a market, that is there are more workers than jobs available, we usually call that unemployment. That's not good. That's inefficient. You have labor resources that are not being utilized. We all get that. High unemployment, I get it. That's a problem. There's a role for government to address that problem. But now when you have the opposite there's not a scarcity of jobs, there's a scarcity of workers. Is that a problem too? If that's a problem too, then we've always got a problem with the labor market. We can never be happy. And that's absurd, right? Mm-hmm. Tight labor markets are wonderful. You know, the reason I have a PhD is because every time I graduated with any degree, there was a slack labor market and I couldn't get a job.
I knew that was coming.
I just hid in school, right? That's not good, right? Maybe it turned out
okay. I think you're a deep Gen Xer. Yeah.
So like high unemployment rates are not good, but tight labor, ask my students if they think tight labor markets are a problem. They don't. You know, when the employers are coming to the university and like, come work for me, that's wonderful, right? What that does is, of course, it forces businesses and employers to use their workers more efficiently. There's nothing better for labor productivity, right? They invest in new technologies to try and get more out of their workers, to help their workers be a little bit more productive. They'll give them some new tech. That's wonderful. They raise wages to compete with other businesses for those scarce workers. That's wonderful. Wages make, like, they increase the dignity of work and make us all feel better about what we're doing, and we work harder as a result. We don't want to lose that high wage job because replacing it might be hard. Those are what we call efficiency wages. This is all good stuff for the economy. But somehow the business lobby in Canada has convinced an entire country that labor shortages are a problem. I find it really quite absurd when I listen to it.
I found that all very interesting. I think I had the fortune of crossing paths with Pierre when I was an even lowlier analyst in Ottawa. He was, I think, guiding some work at Social Services Canada.
So very cool.
What a nice man. We'll definitely look out
Salt
for that
of the
research.
Earth. Oh, yeah,
he was incredible. Yeah. Okay, well, I think that, thank you. I think you've given us a lot to think about there. And I guess by what you're saying is if some of those industries then, if those shortages, so-called, persist, you would think that talented people coming in will start to select themselves into construction and all these other, if there are businesses to be had and set up. So I guess a question I have for you, my final question is, have you looked into this question of, again, I think Canada has a bit of this professionalism-itis where we have guilds that really self-regulate everything from doctors in all kinds of specialties, electricians, I know engineering from my own family, many different engineering groups. And is there a way in which these self-regulating groups act like gatekeepers? It's almost like the union problem, but no one applies it to the white collar worker. Right. And whether you've been able to look into that, about whether that's the reason why more of these new groups of immigrants coming from non-Southern European countries, coming from Asian countries, can't move in whole scale into construction and all these other areas.
Mm. So, I mean, I think the question for an economist is ultimately about skill utilization. You want to track the skills, but when they hit the labor market, you want to make sure that that skill gets utilized. And so the best way, so what typically gets done when people want to see, is there skill underutilization? Are there people with engineering degrees that can't work as engineers, so they can't utilize their skills, they drive taxis instead and get paid low wages? Is that happening? What people usually do in Canada, and Statistics Canada has done a lot of this work, is what you want to see is, you know, does a Canadian worker and an immigrant worker with the same skills earn different wages? You want to condition on the skills and look at earnings. So those are like conditional wage differentials. The problem is, how do I measure skill? And so the way we usually do it, because it's what's usually in the data, is education. So we take an immigrant and a Canadian with the same educational credentials, where the immigrant's credentials are usually from abroad, and then at least in the historical data that were from abroad. So a foreign trained engineer and a Canadian engineer, and look at earnings. And what you see is that, if, you know, on average, the immigrant earns less. Okay, so is that skill underutilization? Well, yeah, maybe, but maybe not. Maybe the education is a really poor measure of skill, at least skill that's relevant in the Canadian labor market and is being rewarded in the Canadian labor market. So then as it begs the question, okay, well, what if we use a more direct measure of skill, not a proxy like education, but we actually go in and try to measure their skills by giving them a test? When you do that, like the OECD, they measure skills of adults quite regularly in something called, there's different names for these data sets. The IELTS is the one that's most, the International Adult Literacy Survey. So they've gone into different countries and try to give them literacy tests. So if you take the Canadian data on that, which is given to immigrants and Canadians, everybody has to write it in English or French if they're in Quebec. And you give them these adult literacy skills, then you can relate their literacy test scores to their earnings, to their wages in the labor market. What you see is very strong relationship, right? Whether they're Canadians or immigrants, people with higher literacy skills on average earn more. Really strong returns to literacy skills. Literacy skills matter a lot in the labor market, right? Here's the question though, is the return to literacy different for immigrants? If immigrant skills are being underutilized, you should see that the return to those literacy skills is lower for immigrants. When you do the honest evidence and you look and estimate this, they're identical. I have research on this. David Green has, there's no difference in the returns of skills. Another example, if you look at immigrants from a particular university, I'm working on a project now where we've linked every graduate of the University of Waterloo since 2005 with all their grades in every class, with all their immigration records and all their income tax records. So at the individual level, we have that data. So we can see, are immigrants earning less because they're lower skill measured using their school grades? Or are they earning less because they struggled? And at Waterloo, there's evidence that their grades are lower, international students. And so that's a really important question. And when you look at those returns, I will leave you hanging for now because we haven't actually released the study, but we will see that evidence. You know, just one other data point. Why in the US are the Indian immigrants earning 20% more and in Canada, Indian immigrants are, is that because we have so much more credential recognition in these professional associations in Canada and more discrimination? I find that hard to believe.
And the counter argument can also be made. Anyways, there's so much into that. Like, I just, I really appreciate though that you're showing us to take some of these, you know, kind of surface beliefs or questions or counter questions. And it's interesting to hear through your research, you're trying to parse it out.
Give you one more data point? So here, the way that we select economic class immigrants is the express entry system. That system is very much trying to cream skim the highest skills. You can very clearly see that over the period of, you know, introducing pre-migration language testing, express entry systems, where we're trying to measure skill better to cream skim the top talent, what you see is those earnings differentials are getting smaller and smaller and smaller over time. Immigrants' earnings are improving. Now, I find that hard to believe that that's all these credential recognition problems. I think it's just we're doing a better job. It's not more skill utilization. It's just selecting higher quality immigrants, higher skilled immigrants.
So much more to think about. Thank you. I'm going to leave it. John, I think you had a closing sort of thought question.
We can leave it at that, I guess. We've taken up so much of your time already. So thank you again for joining us and unpacking a lot of these questions that we had. We really appreciate it.
We have to do a part two.
No, we might have to one day.
After your results are, I would really love to drill down on more of this and also the connection between, the immigration to Canada, the housing labor problem, and then, you know, and whether there's more to be done on that front. So we'd love to have you back if you will, if you would be open to it.
Sure.